Greetings, everyone. You're with Norm Schultz, Chalmer Wren, and I'm Nick Erkus. This is the Mile High Sanity Project, and you're in it.
Welcome, everybody. It's back to the Mile High Sanity Project here. And wouldn't you know it, we are just about nearly but not quite caught up with our Cosmos review, but we're back. We are back here. And by we, I of course mean all three. That's right, everyone. We're like that holy trinity or that trio you're looking for. Not Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, no. But pretty close. Pretty close. My name is Nick Erkus. I'm here with Norm Schultz.
Hello, everybody.
And Chalmer Wren.
How's it going?
I'm going good.
We could be Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
I'm definitely Kirk.
No.
I don't think so.
You're Spock.
You're Spock.
Clearly.
Yeah.
I'm Kirk. I'm the oldest. I have to wear a girdle.
Well, yeah, but Bones is the oldest.
Oh, well, I'm not Bones.
I feel like I'm probably more of Bones because I am kind of a cynical bastard about
it. Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, you know? I agree.
I'm kind of a Russian where angels fear to tread.
Yeah. He's dead, Jim. We're about halfway through our journey through the cosmos here, our space-time odyssey. This is episode 6.
Wow.
Deeper,
deeper, deeper. Through the entire cosmos.
That's right. And it only took 6 episodes, too. So,
how many? Do they know how many episodes they're doing?
13.
13? Yes. Nice.
Yeah.
One series.
All righty.
No, it's good. And this one here was all kind of about levels of existence is what it starts off with. And I got to say, Chalmer, this one I felt was kind of right up your avenue. Pretty heavy chemistry stuff here.
I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah, and the whole scale issue, that's what they're starting out with. This is one more thing that if you don't have access to telescopes and microscopes, as in, you know, you just go back a few hundred years, you have just no clue at the scale of these objects, modes of reality, organisms, on any of this stuff.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you have no scale of time, and you have no scale of space as well.
Right. Right. We'll talk about this a little bit more in detail later. That's something that's amazing that some ancient cultures or old cultures had conceptual ideas of the very small.
Well, very, very small group of people,
right,
or individuals, well, even.
That's a better way of putting it. But that kind of is crazy. When you consider all this stuff, the kind of information we know about it, it's probably all like 19th century stuff, right? Or 20th century stuff, probably more, I suppose, like the last 100 years of, as far as observations go, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we didn't even know that there were other galaxies until, you know, within
the 20th century, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was recent.
It might only be like 80 years old or something like that.
Yeah,
even.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe that's the kind of thing that we should look up and do a correction. Nick and I were talking before the show about other podcasts and how sometimes podcasts will start out with corrections. We don't do that.
No, we guesstimate.
Right. I'm sure that we do occasionally say things that are wrong. Hopefully the gist is right.
It's more of an approximation of reality, really. That's all we're trying to do. Get pretty close.
Well, I've thought about this actually. I don't want to go off on this tangent too long, but I don't want to have to be an expert in order to speak reasonably intelligent about things. I think that that's too high of an expectation.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, we do a little bit of research on these shows, but we don't go crazy on the research. We want to just keep the conversation, you know, enjoyable and not overly technical. So
just a few good men like Jack Nicholson. I'm an educated man, but I'm afraid I can't speak intelligently as to the habits of atoms.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Good morning, Chalmer.
Yeah.
So
here's an interesting
thing. I mentioned the very beginning of the episode, but
well, I mean, something they say at the very beginning, I mean, there are as far as scales and as far as quantities of things that we know about. So he says there are more atoms in your eye than stars in all the galaxies.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know how many stars in all the galaxies there are, there are at least 10. There's more than that. It's a ridiculous number.
Correction later.
Right.
There's a lot.
Apparently,
yeah,
there are more stars and grains of sand on the planet Earth. So,
yeah.
So, so more atoms in your eye than that. And that's huge. He says that the human being is made up of about 3 billion, billion, billion atoms.
Yeah.
And they all come together in a nice little symmetric way that says norm.
You can't fathom a billion of anything, really. I mean, you talk about a billionaire, so we use the term billion, and it becomes quote-unquote familiar. But nobody here is familiar with the concept of a billion of anything.
No.
Yeah, too big.
And so a billion, 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 I mean, forget it. That's so beyond comprehension or intuition.
I think it's one of the hardest things about talking about certain areas of science, actually. Because you want to try and connect it with people in a way they understand. In our minds, when you get like into ideas of like deep time, the kind of deep time you need to understand certain concepts like the history of the universe or evolution,
right.
Or just the amount of like numbers when you try and quantify certain things on like an atomic level. I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around it, but and I understand it.
Yeah, and you know, scientific notation is a double-edged sword. It does simplify the process quite a lot, but it also hides how big the numbers are. It makes them look small. You just get used to, you know, 10 to the 20th, 10 to the 22nd. Yeah.
Well, when you get down to this level, we're always limited by our – like we try and come up with the best analogy we could think of to make it big enough for our brain to kind of wrap your head around it. They're always like, you know, instead of an atom, the small level, let's imagine an atom like the size of a two-mile city.
Yeah.
Where the nucleus or the proton is the size of a golf ball.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa.
I think the analogy,
weird things like that.
So. The analogy that Neil deGrasse Tyson used, it wasn't this episode, I think, was that of the big cathedral that he was in.
That was this episode. He said it'd be the size of a mote of dust.
Yeah. So the nucleus, that's where all the matter and the weight, the mass of the atom is, would be the size of a speck of dust. It's just mind-boggling.
It is.
Yeah. The fact that atoms are mostly empty space, and when you touch things, that is. Am I getting ahead of myself?
We're getting a little bit ahead. Let's rise back up a little bit here because we're going deeper.
He does start off talking about the tardigrades again, though, too, right?
They did. Well, actually, before they got in there, they kind of entered the little miniature cosmos of the dewdrop.
Right.
And in my notes, I put in here the plight of the Paramecium because they showed like the Paramecium being attacked. So.
Yes. It reminded me of the scene in the first of the how do I say this properly? The redo of Star Wars. The Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
That was the first one. Remember where they're down in the ocean?
Of course.
And you got the, you know, there's always a bigger fish. Reminded me of that.
I'm an uber Star Wars nerd. I like all of them, even the bad ones. So
yeah.
Yeah. I know everything.
So, you know, I actually didn't realize that there was predatory behavior at that level.
Oh, yeah.
Me neither. I was kind of astounded. It's only like a one-celled organism.
I know. And you know, I did a little bit of research about tardigrades. Apparently, there are a couple of subspecies of tardigrades that are predators as well.
Really?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, the water bear came back in this episode. It's interesting. I've heard people talk about, you know, some of the people who want to advance the possible, you know, notion that maybe life on Earth came from outer space in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Like it evolved in space and could survive interstellar space and then crashed here and, you know, and was around. And they say the creatures like the tardigrade that can survive such extreme environments, super extreme environments, why would it need to be able to survive in the vacuum of space? Like, why would these things have this, like, super extreme, like, ability?
Accidental consequence, right?
I think so, too. I think it's a little bit of a stretch, but there are scientists or biologists, I think, who look to that sort of thing when they're trying to see if it's possible for life to, you know, survive, like, an impact on one planet and move through space
I think it might be possible to survive. The problem is the time, right?
Yeah.
So the tardigrade can live for a very, very long time, about 10 years, without water. That's a very, very long time. But that's nothing compared to how long it would take to get anywhere in space. Yeah. So
you would think that would explain life maybe from one planet to another within a solar system. But if we're talking about interstellar.
Yeah, that's right.
And then intergalactic, forget it. There would have to be a tremendous amount of evidence for me to even consider, you know, accepting that kind of theory.
I think for anyone too. I mean, it's pretty. I don't know if it's fringe, but it's just so speculative. It's hard to take it.
Are some bacterium that seem to be able to exist in a state of I forget the term, but hibernation,
like a super hibernation,
right?
For what seems like an infinite amount of time.
Huh.
I didn't know that, but still, though.
I didn't know that either.
We're talking chemistry in this episode. You got to take it all with a big grain of, you know, NCAL or whatever. Nerd. All right, so. Well, they go down, like, I thought it was cool how they were kept going down smaller and smaller scales. And we got to get smaller, we got to get smaller.
Yeah.
When they went into the dewdrop and...
By the way, with the tardigrade, another thing I discovered is that they're actually fairly easy to find on moist moss. So I now have a personal project of seeing a tardigrade with my own eyes at some point.
Well, you've got a good chance to, because something I wrote down from the episode is that the tardigrade to human ratio is about... 1 billion to one. One billion of them, one of us.
Yeah. And wow. I read that it's actually fairly easy. Like, you know, you guys know this. I don't know if I announced this on the show that I'm working towards getting certified as a science teacher. I think that this could be an activity that you may give to students to give them some moist moss and have them maybe in the course of a class period or maybe two try to find a tardigrade.
Extra credit.
Be a lot of fun.
It'll be the class pet. the class water bear.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Don't feed the bears.
I would imagine that it's possible to see it alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And apparently it doesn't take a high magnification. I read that a tardigrade can get as long as about a millimeter.
Really?
Yeah, they're not that small.
Which means you
– because they said about the size of a pinhead.
Could you see it with the naked eye?
I mean, it's a millimeter.
A millimeter with the naked eye.
I think it's pretty close to the limit.
Maybe just with a regular magnifying glass then.
Maybe. You know, you'd have to find it. But I don't know. That whole project of seeing one for real intrigues me now. So that's got to happen.
Well, these things they said on the show also, I wrote down, they predate human beings by about 500 million years.
Yeah.
So all five mass extinctions, as Chalmers said before, they probably didn't even notice it.
That makes them twice our lifespan, if you will, as far as the species. It's my understanding that modern humans have existed for between 100 million and 500 million years.
I don't know if you would have called it Homo sapiens at that point.
Not modern humans.
No, not modern human, they say maybe.
Oh, no, 1,000. Yeah. 1,000.
Yeah.
200,000 years.
Here's one of our corrections.
I read 500,000 years. Will
they keep going more? I mean,
sorry about the millions. I got to have another sip of coffee to get the brain going. But
certain scientists debated. I think, this was years ago. I mean, like, I think Francis Collins used to think maybe only 100,000 years. Richard Dawkins thought maybe around 250 to 300,000, I think.
Yeah, I think that debate is a little bit on the older side.
It might be, because that's probably...
Let's look this up offline. Yeah.
Yeah. We won't tell you the answer, but we'll look it up, so we'll know.
I'm pretty sure it's 200.
I'm pretty sure you're wrong.
Well, you know, they go down to the deeper level here of looking at plants, looking down, all the way down to chlorophyll. I don't know what Billy Madison was talking about. Chlorophyll... Because it was not like borophyll to me. I thought it was really interesting. I don't know. I mean,
borophyll.
I got borophyll man up here talking about God knows what.
I'm giggling, but I actually have no idea what you're talking about.
Have you never seen Billy Madison?
I don't know what you're talking about. Still, is this a movie?
It is.
Oh, okay.
Well, early Adam Sandler, back when he was good.
Oh, so, back when he was good. You know what? Yes, Adam Sandler. So that I'm out. That's why.
It's one of the good ones, though. One of the few. So
only Adam Sandler that I'll watch is Punch Drunk Love. The rest is...
you can do better than that. You can do better. You get down to they started getting way down to the atomic level when they got down to that chlorophyll. And here's where I felt that it got really into really cool visuals. They had kind of like the inside of the... Charmer, was that the inside of a chloroplast? What were they inside of right there?
I believe they were inside of a plant cell, and then they went inside of a chloroplast.
The whole animation they had of it being kind of like a factory and showing how it was breaking apart the atoms on an atomic level, I thought that was crazy.
It was very cool.
Something I wrote down was that plant collective process about 6 times more power than our entire civilization. And they're better at it than we are. And we can it's funny because we understand pretty well, I'd say, what's happening and how it's happening. But we just can't do it as well as plants.
Right.
I mean,
yeah. In terms of efficiency, they've got it nailed.
Cool. You're talking about, isn't the process glycolysis? Is that what we're talking about?
I don't know what the process is called of photosynthesis at that level.
Oh, photosynthesis.
It's photosynthesis.
It's just photosynthesis.
Glycolysis is later.
Yeah, glycolysis, that's turning sugar into usable energy.
Right, exactly.
I missed this. I spaced for a second. We have the ability to photosynthesize? No,
we understand.
No.
We understand what's happening.
We've tried to hijack photosynthesis in order to make things like biofuels and stuff. We just haven't been able to do it very efficiently.
Evolution has billions of years on us, and we just can't do it as well.
I thought you guys were joining the Eat the Sun crowd.
You know
about those guys, right?
I'm not familiar.
Oh, yeah. They think
Chalmer does, because he's into
– want to sunbathe and – oh, jeez. Yeah,
did you see the documentary Eat the Sun?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
It was pretty bad.
We got to do an episode on that. Nick, just to give you a quick snippet, there are a group of people who feel that you can just not eat at all. Just look at the sun, and you can get the energy you need directly from it. And so there are people out there that are looking with their naked eyes at the sun. Of course, they're ruining their eyesight. It's hilarious.
Yeah, the longer they go without food, the more gullible they get. It's kind of funny.
You know what they say about light on the sun all day, but their vitamin E content way up.
Their blood sugar goes down, and therefore they're more susceptible to strange beliefs.
They get dumber and dumber, and they just die.
Oh my God,
brain is being whitewashed out or something almost.
I'm going to laugh about that again a couple of times today.
Well, where does it go down to next? Let's see.
It goes deeper, deeper still.
Deeper, deeper, deeper still.
You know, next they kind of shifted over to talking about flowers. I didn't understand, how do we know that the first flowering plants appeared about 100 million years ago? How do we?
Oh, well, fossil record for one.
The fossil record will show that?
Yeah, there were no flowering plants for most of the history of life. They're a recent evolutionary thing.
Well, in order to have flowers, you need insects.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So you can indirectly corroborate any evidence you have with the age of insects.
Yeah, and not even necessarily insects. You need something that's going to help them pollinate at least, though.
Yeah, generally.
Well, speaking of that, here's another great thing the show did. This whole series has been really, really not holding back at all, saying like, you know, this is what the evidence is, and it's evolution. It's evolution by natural selection.
Maybe that's back when Norm's 100 million year old cavemen started planting flowers.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, they had they talked about Darwin and how the theory of evolution with natural selection, that he predicted that some kind of creature had to exist on Madagascar. Do you recall that? There is some species of orchid.
And this is an awesome part of the show.
Right. And people
will complain that evolution doesn't make any predictions.
Here's a great one.
There's actually material in the philosophical literature about people arguing that evolution is a tautology. The theory is that the fittest survive, and how do you determine the fittest? Well, the fittest is the ones that survive, and you know that's an oversimplification of the complaint. But people do make the complaint that evolution is a fishy theory, that it's not actually testable because it just fits any hypothesis, and it's not true.
No,
you can make predictions, and that's exactly what Darwin did, which is amazing. Yeah. The more you learn about Darwin as a person. It's just amazing what he was able to do and how right he was.
I didn't know that he made this prediction, and it took 50 years to be observationally confirmed when they when they found that gigantic kind of fucking Mothra living on Madagascar.
Just crazy. And
they said that thing's tongue is a foot long, so if I saw it, I wouldn't be a very good scientist because I'd immediately be like, kill it! Because
wouldn't it be great if it was discovered when he was alive so that he could have just, you know, said I told you so and then died?
It would be, but in some way, I think it kind of gives a little bit more vindication to it. Kind of like Halley's Comet that came back like 50 years after he was gone and it confirmed it.
Yeah.
It's more of a postscript, but he predicted it. Because just by looking at this flower, it said it couldn't probably exist unless something could pollinate it.
Yep, got to be there.
That means that some kind of life form has to be able to do it.
Yep.
And that makes sense. I thought that was great. And it's another just an example of how this show is going after showing people what we think we know about things and why. I mean, Neil says there's no greater test of a theory, perhaps, than its predictive qualities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is a great example of it for evolution.
Yeah. And it makes plenty of other predictions as well, but it's just great that – early on, that kind of prediction was not only offered as a way of testing the theory, but turned out to be right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think from here, the show kind of did a little digression as Neil talks about how smell and memories and like what's happening on kind of an atomic level.
I thought the same thing. I thought, oh, this is not exactly real. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like, I think the way it kind of tied in is that he's saying, like, you know, it still was kind of like on an atomic level, what is happening with scent?
Right.
And what are those molecules stimulating in your nose and then stimulating going through your brain? I thought that was interesting when they kind of showed the pathway that it takes, like what those, what that structure in your brain is close to, like the area that forms memories,
yeah,
the area that's tied to emotion.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. I mean, you know.
And this doesn't affect us guys as much because, as it turns out, guys just don't have very good senses of smell.
Really?
Women have very good senses of smell. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
And I think it's been proposed that there are various evolutionary reasons for that. But, you know, that for hunting, the way we hunt, the smell was not as important as for other animals. But for protecting yourself, smell was really important. So, yeah.
Well, they talk about that even in the show. I mean, they were saying, like, you know, if you could smell, you know, something like an approaching predator,
yeah,
or if you could smell like a forest fire coming to you or something like that.
Yeah. Chalmer, does that jive with your knowledge of that as well?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
Memories are weird. That'd be fun to do an entire episode sometime on how we think we form memories and that sort of thing.
So what's weird to me is to think that if you didn't know better, like, I would feel like the molecules would be like going into my brain or something, but that's not what happens at all. It just sets off a mechanism.
They go in. Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by into your brain. I would say the nerve endings in your nose are kind of like an extension of your brain
because
they travel directly to it.
They propagate it.
Pretty direct route.
Brain tentacles.
Yeah. They just fit into the receptors that trigger, you know, certain kinds of signals.
Right.
That's crazy.
And it's interesting. Like, yeah, Norm said, like, you know, only that exact smell for me can unlock the vault for that memory.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah.
I've once heard, you know, when I was back taking classes in, I think one of my criminology classes I took, they were talking about how memories are difficult because of how we form them and how unreliable witnesses' memories can be in particular. Right. But they said that this guy's analogy was to think of memories as a whole series of balloons floating, and the string is tied to an idea. So when someone says baseball, the balloon, the string that's attached to baseball gets tugged, and that balloon moves. But he said the thing with memories is that you have other strings all tied to each other. Yeah. So maybe you hear baseball, you think of something totally unrelated to baseball,
yeah,
and they're like, why would you do that? Because those, you know, you're bumping into other strings, you're activating other memories with it.
Right.
And I felt that was an interesting analogy, one that's always stuck with me from school from that. But
yeah, I mean, when you say baseball, I just think of sex.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
We're
all trying to get the home base, so
I'm kidding around.
Oh, okay.
Tom was trying to figure it out. I was like, "This makes sense, though." he's like, "Now I want to play baseball, honey."
Quote unquote.
Yeah. Well, another interesting thing, they moved on to next, still keeping with like the atomic level of looking at things, looking at the air we breathe and the way it gets circulated around from an atomic level. I think Neil called it like atomic reincarnation. And every breath contains about, what, 100, like hundreds of molecules that pass through the lungs of everyone else around us, probably.
And there was this just great visual. You know, I maybe we don't say enough about the way these episodes are filmed.
They're beautiful.
They're absolutely beautiful, and the illustration, the way that they are not only beautiful, but they're really good at illustrating the points that are made. In that scene, he takes a breath in, and you see like these
little molecules.
Yeah, moving in and then moving out. It was just amazing the way they did that.
Neil says, "Breathe with me." How many of you did it? Who took a breath with Neil?
I did.
Okay. I did. Okay. I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you know who filmed this. I think the guy who filmed the Matrix trilogy is the guy who filmed this.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, they brought in some pretty heavy firepower to make it look as good as they could.
Well, and it's got such clout that imagine it wasn't, you know, it kind of sells itself. You want to be part of this project? Yeah.
I would hope everyone does.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's awesome. from here, this is where they kind of first go back in time in this episode, and they take us back about 2,500 years ago, back to my people, the Greeks.
Yep. Say it.
Well, you know, you like art, you like theater and democracy. You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, sorry we couldn't get that to you sooner, okay? Yeah.
Thales.
Yes.
And you know what's great? And it's funny, while I'm pursuing a job in science teaching, I sometimes get weird looks because they see my philosophy background. And sometimes people will say, well, I don't understand the connection between the two.
How could you not?
Oh, my God.
I know.
You're like, what you should just tell them is like everything that you think about, philosophers invented.
Yeah, pretty much. And so, you know, I think it's great that this episode talks about Thales in the light of like one of the first people to think in terms of the way physics turns out to actually be. Because Thales, if you know any philosophy, Thales is regarded as officially the first philosopher as well.
Is he really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yep.
I love philosophy, and I always, you know, that's something I probably wish I would have majored in, actually. But I didn't want to teach it, so I figured, what can I really do with this? So I didn't teach, and also I didn't want to go back and start again because I would have involved switching a major to a third major. So
it's almost too obvious to say, but philosophy is one of the most impractical majors because.
Yeah.
But it is a lot of fun.
I love it, and I always tell. I mean, I do like science, and I understand the scientific method. But instead of considering myself kind of like a layperson scientist, I really do consider myself more always as a philosopher.
Yeah.
First and foremost.
That's what's great about philosophy. You don't actually have to major in it to be well educated in it.
That's what I figured.
It's a lifelong pursuit.
Right. I figured I could just read the books and stuff and read that stuff.
And read and talk about them and just, you know, try to use the basic thinking skills of philosophy, which are really the same as the thinking skills of science. It's just, you know, it's a Tupperware thing. Which bin do you put it in?
Right.
If it's something that can't be, you know, settled by observation, empirical work, then you'll call it philosophy. But the process is really the same. Now, there are a lot of philosophers that would disagree with me, but you know, I think philosophy has kind of gotten a little out of hand in the last few hundred years, but regardless.
I think you'd agree. I mean, whenever I, quote, do philosophy, whenever I'm reading it and thinking about it, I feel like a very profound connection to those thinkers whenever I find myself understanding their ideas. Not whether I agree with it or not isn't the point. Even in fact, maybe it's more important that I would have a Socratic argument against them in some ways if they were around. But whenever I read something that, you know, is attributed to Socrates or Plato or anyone throughout the years like that, and I feel like I'm understanding it, that it's not over my head, I like that. I feel like a kind of almost like a weird kinship with it.
Sure.
I don't know. Like, Chalmers, do you get that whenever you're doing like more of science stuff and you're using science techniques that have been used by other scientists?
Oh, absolutely. It's the whole idea that, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Sure.
You feel that kind of sentimental attachment to your work.
Right. Yeah.
And that connectedness. It can be quite fulfilling.
And it's a nice blend of competition and cooperation too. You know, like members of a basketball team, you're kind of competing with each other to play better, but you're also trying to accomplish the same goal. And I think that, again, I do think that philosophy has gotten out of hand, and so it's, I think, almost too combative. But at the same time, I think there's a core of philosophy that really is engaged in the same kind of objective as the sciences, which is just trying to figure things out.
This is a bit of a digression here, but do you like when people have distinctions between Eastern and Western philosophy, or should we just call it philosophy?
I don't like that. In fact, in a job interview, I didn't get the job. But in a job interview, one of the criteria for the job was you must be willing to teach Eastern philosophy. And I determined that, you know, I'm not gonna tell people what they want to hear. Philosopher means, you know, you tell it like you think it is, and you back it up. And in the interview, I told them that I'm willing to teach the subject matter, but I don't like the distinction of Eastern philosophy because there isn't Eastern and Western philosophy. There's really just philosophy.
Right.
The enterprise is not geographic in nature. It's not like truth is somehow different in one location than
another. I feel
another.
Exactly the same. I'm on the same page with you with this. I've heard people try and like separate logic out that way. And I'm like, you know, we don't
Eastern
have
and Western logic.
Well, I'm like, we don't have like, I'm not like, hey, let's discuss Chinese math today.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know, or like, you know, Chalmers had to learn Indian chemistry. I mean, it's just chemistry.
This is actually something that's still a real issue for me now. As I transition to becoming a science teacher, one of the things I'm learning in the Denver area is that there are a good number of schools that want you to receive a certification in what's called cultural and linguistic diversity. And so what they want you to have this certification in for is so that you can teach the class in a way that reaches students of different cultures than you. And I'm all for that. And I'm probably going to get that certification at some point because it's actually really valuable. And I'm okay with it from the perspective of how pedagogy, right? How you teach. But when I applied for this program, I made it clear to them that you guys should treat applicants like me slightly differently than applicants in like the humanities and English and social studies, because in science there is no such thing as culture in science, and not in the way that you're talking about. There is no cultural diversity in science. I mean, gravity works the same here as it does in India, China, and Africa, and everywhere else. I mean, these things are universal. So in a way, I understand the project, but we can't take this too far either. I mean, if you have a belief that is based on your cultural upbringing in a science class, well,
I say it's almost irrelevant. I mean, like the
if that belief happens to be in line with the evidence, that's fine. But if it doesn't, sorry, it's not culturally insensitive to simply say that's not. It's just not the way it is.
Neil deGrasse Tyson and other scientists have said we should conform our beliefs to the evidence,
right?
Not the other way around.
Yeah,
the universe doesn't really care what your culture thinks.
Right.
It is what it is.
So, yeah, I mean, I worry about that kind of thing a little bit, but how did we get on this subject?
Well, we were talking about Thales, and, you know, and we were talking about the things being the way they are. He's one of the first people in history who thought maybe there's a naturalistic explanation other than Zeus is pretty pissed today.
It's my understanding that he's the first person that we know of who actually tried to answer a question, with a significant question, by using his powers of reason and his powers of observation.
Right. And it's interesting. They said that there's.
Does any of his work survive today?
No. They mentioned in the show.
I think we just know about him through Aristotle.
I was wondering how we know about him then, because they said that none of the works attributed to him survived.
Yeah.
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 But
and that's true of most
Aristotle
of the
was an honest guy.
Philosophers, right?
I want to say that he was mentioned in a Socratic dialogue, but I don't know that with confidence. So.
Yeah.
Well, one more thing for correction later.
Right. Well, then they also didn't talk about Democritus. Clearly, he had no valuable ideas to add. Democritus.
Yeah, he is the inventor of the idea of the atom.
That
can you believe that?
No, I don't. I have no idea how would you even reason that out and think about that? I can't wrap my mind around what he wrapped his mind around.
An indivisible, very tiny object that is the same everywhere and that everything else is made of a combination of it. And really, the foundation of that was laid by Thales, because he thought that everything was made of one kind of stuff. He thought it was water. Democritus thought, well, you know, I understand the idea of everything being made of one kind of thing. In a way, when you reason it out, at some point it just makes sense that it would be one kind of thing from their thinking, because otherwise it would lead to an infinite regress of different kinds of things. And you had a philosopher named Parmenides around that time who was saying that logic tells you that at some point down the level of existence, existence must be singular, because at some point something either exists or it doesn't. The only option is for it to exist or not. So existence itself has got to be a singular thing, because the only other thing is not existing, and that doesn't exist. And so these guys were influenced by that, so they thought that logically speaking there must be some common element. Of course, Thales was before Parmenides, so Thales kind of got the ball rolling on all this stuff.
Still, though, it's ridiculous that 2,500 years ago people were thinking of this shit.
Yeah.
It blows. Several times in this series, I've had to scrape brain off the ceiling because my mind is blown. And I just finished cleaning up from last week's episode on light, and then this happened, and I'm just like, people were thinking about this 2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
We have people now who think that human beings rode on dinosaurs with saddles. And yet people back then, some people, few people, but still were able to think about this sort of shit. And this sort of thing gives me a little bit of pride in philosophy a little bit, you know, when these guys are just reasoning that sort of stuff out. And it's awesome. So
yep.
What does Adam – Adam is, comes from a Greek word that meant something, and I can't remember what it was.
I think it just means indivisible particle.
That's right. Yeah. Indivisible. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was crazy to me. This is where the episode then talked about how, you know, like when that little boy gives the girl the flowers and, you know, touches her on the cheek, and the dad comes out and Neil's like, well, hold on there, Dad. He didn't actually touch her. We don't actually touch anyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, is this the...
I think that's silly, though, because that's just in a kind of equivocation on the word touch.
Yeah. It just helps you on dates that we can honestly tell the father, never touched her. Didn't. Don't know what you're talking about. I can honestly tell you that the nuclei that are part of me didn't touch hers. Wouldn't do it. Yeah, and that was – I thought the visual there was cool, showing how you've got that kind of like that, you know, invisible little electron cloud out there that stops, acts like a buffer. That sort of thing is kind of crazy to me. The whole idea of electrons, Chalmers, still is kind of crazy to me. How they, you know, how they work and how much we know about them, given that we can't observe them.
Yeah, it's weird.
I didn't understand. Maybe I did. I just forgot about this. Neil says there's an upper limit to the number of neutrons that you could stuff into a nucleus of an atom.
Yeah.
Before it becomes unstable.
Yeah, that's why all the heavy
fall apart.
Elements are so fleeting.
Right.
You know, the further up the periodic table, the more unstable they get. And so some of those are – I think it's almost silly to call them even elements.
Don't some of them exist for a matter of moments if
less than that? Fractions, sub-fractions of seconds.
What they're trying to do now is to get all the way to the end of that row, because they're hoping that at the end of the row we'll have a super stable noble gas, but it'll be super heavy because it has – that would have so many practical applications, but really it's probably not going to happen.
I don't understand the logic of that because, I mean, I understand the basic logic of the law of octets, right? You're trying to get that to have the 8 electrons, but the problem is not the electrons. The problem is the nucleons.
Right.
So I guess I don't understand that project. Why would they expect that to be stable?
I don't know from an atomic point of view, but I think that there are reasons to think that it would be more stable.
Would it be mathematically? That's the way the math balances out.
It has to do with the way the nucleus is arranged.
I would, but
I don't know the details.
I don't understand that. I can understand it being theoretically chemically stable, but I don't see how it can be, you know, stable in a nuclear way.
Right.
Well, neither do I.
The problem is, like, in order to test this kind of stuff, we kind of need a, you know, an accelerator the size of the sun. You know, because the sun is the only thing that we know of right now that has no problem with fusion. It's just kind of what it does.
Yeah. And it's just a consequence of gravity.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that still blows my mind, is that all this stuff, all the elements that we are made of, is really just a consequence of a basic particle, you know, two of them, proton and an electron, and gravity.
Right.
That's how you get all these elements, through this process, of this birth and death of stars that really exists just because of gravity.
It's also cool to think of, you know, helium, I think Neil calls it, is the ash that our star makes. You know,
yeah.
Like it crushes that, you know, hydrogen and makes helium. And our star is not big or hot enough to make any heavier elements. It can't fuse helium. You know, right. You've got those stars out there that have, you know.
I thought it can temporarily fuse helium.
I don't think it – well, in Cosmos you said it couldn't. Maybe it can at a small amount.
Yeah, I thought the really big stars, when they go through the end-of-life cycle, that they temporarily fuse helium.
Oh, the big stars fuse helium, and then they fuse everything up to iron, and then they blow up. You can't fuse anything heavier than iron.
I thought there was
they fuse heavier elements in the process of going supernova. Then you'll fuse iron and the heavier stuff.
Right.
But they have like cores of you have a core of helium and a core of everything, like a core of oxygen.
Yeah, no, I know that.
A core of carbon.
I thought there was another stage where they don't actually get to that process, but they start fusing helium. I don't remember. Chalmers, does this ring a bell to you, or am I completely wrong?
No, that sounds right, actually.
I just don't remember
when they come near the end of their life.
I don't remember which kind of star it is. But.
I don't think it's ours, but I know what you're talking about.
So. Yeah.
Well, this kind of moved into the part episode that really blew my mind was the discussion on neutrinos, which I thought I knew a little bit about before. But you know, I was just kind of like, fuck me, the whole time when they were talking about some of the stuff that they went through.
I kind of impressed Laura because when we're watching the episode and then the next scene switches and he's in the little raft in the pool with all the bulbs. After seeing that for about a second, I go, neutrinos. And Laura looks at me like, what are you talking about? And then pretty soon he talks about neutrinos. So, yeah,
I scored a
geek point there.
Well, what blew my mind about neutrinos was never saying that the neutrinos show up about sometimes 3 hours before we get the light of a supernova.
Isn't that amazing?
My mind immediately was like, what?
Yeah, mine was too. Like, how in the world? And then when he explained it, it just made perfect sense.
It made perfect sense. I had no idea that they did that.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, I guess, I know that they go through everything else so easily. I always forget. And it's easy to forget that how long it takes fucking light to get out of a star.
Yeah, I just realized that this is something that sci-fi people should develop.
Yeah.
That ships have a neutrino detector that when it goes off, that means get the ship the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
Because in about 3 hours, this star is going bye-bye.
Well, that would be a pretty good early detection unit of like, see, this is why no one had to die on Krypton. Jor-El didn't have to explain to them. They didn't have to believe that the star wasn't going to blow up.
Oh, my God. This just throws a whole wrench in a lot of sci-fi disasters that would be caused by supernovas.
Because in Superman, they don't believe Jor-El that the star is going to blow up. They would have got a neutrino burst a few hours before.
Yeah, they're way advanced. Wow, yeah, this just totally wrecked some sci-fi for me.
There you go, people. Superman is not real.
You're welcome.
No need to thank us. Oh, see, a cease and desist letter here.
We're losing our female crowd right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, so when the star is blowing up, Neil says,
"What's her name again?"
Right. Laura, I think Norm's wife listens to us occasionally.
She doesn't listen to this show.
Never mind. Oh, we actually have negative female viewers somehow. It's like,
yeah.
Well, like this. So the star is blowing up. The neutrinos just go, we're out of here, and just fuck off immediately.
Yeah.
But the star, it might take hours to actually blow itself apart because of how big it is and how massive it is. You've got that shock wave of exploding gas moves at 1/10,000th the speed of light, I wrote down.
Hey, Chalmer, you're smart. Why do they need water to detect neutrinos? I don't get it. I mean, if neutrinos pass through everything, what the hell difference does it make if water is there?
I actually don't know the answer to that.
I don't get it.
Because then you have nothing to sit in the boat.
Yeah, I mean, I also just want to say whoever it was that figured out how to detect neutrinos, how the process by which they did that, I bet that's a really great science story.
I would really like to learn it and talk about it.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting. We got to do a straight up physics episode and make a list of questions to ask a physicist.
I think that's one of them.
Yeah.
Well, we're
talking about doing that, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Well, they talk about the guy who predicted. Again, we're talking about a theory and its predictive qualities. Just circled back to how Darwin did it. But they talk about Wolfgang Pauli.
Yeah.
Wolfgang is just a cool name that you don't hear enough nowadays.
And he's obviously the Pauli of the Pauli exclusion principle, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't put that together until just now. Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah, which the Pauli exclusion principle is having to do with quantum particles that can't occupy the same space. Is that? Mm-hmm. I forget exactly what it is.
Well, Wolfgang predicted that something has to be there because of the law of conservation of energy. Because they saw that occasionally, I think as Neil put it, and I like the visual of it, showing a little tiny electron pop off of a atom. And it says, like, you know, an atom loses an electron, changes into a different element. And
in the process, there would be an energy difference.
They added it up, and there seemed there was a missing amount of energy.
Where does it go?
Right. You know, and right, and he said, well, it has to go someplace. because what we seem to know about those laws you can't break in nature, like the law of conservation of energy, we can't create new energy. So it has to be someplace. And I don't know how long he lived. Did he live long enough for the neutrino to be discovered? Do you know that, Chalmer?
That I don't know.
Again,
Pauli exclusion principle is about electrons.
It's about fermions. It has to do with the four quantum numbers, and no two fermions can occupy all four at the same time.
Is an electron a subset or a subset of fermions?
Yeah. So there's bosons and fermions, and they're separated out by half and a whole integer spin.
If an electron is a fermion, but what else is a fermion?
What else is a fermion? I think, let me see.
Fermions are particles which have half integer spin. Okay, that makes sense.
I think photons are fermions.
Protons,
neutrons,
and neutrons.
Protons.
It doesn't say photons.
Maybe photons are bosons. No, they are bosons. Never mind.
So I guess they don't. So photons do not have a spin, correct?
Why do scientists have to name everything that's something that rhymes?
What's interesting about this kind of stuff is this has to do with the conservation of information, right? The orientation of the spin is part of the information that basically you could rewind to the beginning of the universe.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
You know, this is part of all those. Like Neil mentions that for a rule to be considered a law, it's got to be nearly, as far as we can tell, unbreakable.
Right.
This is the part of the episodes I wrote down in my notes, Cannonball Run, because Neil's holding the cannonball up to his head with like the pendulum and just lets it go.
Yeah.
And it just comes right back up and he doesn't flinch.
I'm glad that he gave some safety instructions too.
Right. He's like, don't give it any more energy because bad things will happen to your face.
And make sure you don't lean.
Right.
Right.
That was, I think I would flinch still.
I don't think I would. As long as I let it look with the hand in the back and you just release it, I don't think I would. I think I would be okay.
Me too.
I want to try it.
Should we do that?
We should. Last week I wanted to build a camera obscura. Now I want to do this.
Chalmer and I are going to, at some point, hopefully this year, work on some chemistry experiments in my basement. Maybe I'll set up a little pendulum.
Nice.
That would be cool.
I expect you guys to have beakers that are bubbling with stuff, though. And like wear lab coats.
Hopefully not exploding.
That's the classic bubbling beaker experiment.
Right. Yes. Hopefully not exploding. Though
hopefully
I don't know.
Not exploding. Safely exploding.
You know, we could do something that exploded in the back. And by the way, we should film these, and if they're good enough, we maybe should put them up on the Mile High Sanity Project.
Well, destruction is always good. Especially explosions could easily lead to unexpected hilarious consequences. That's one of the laws of the universe, too, although not a scientific.
At this point in the show, if anyone would like to donate some of that weird stuff they may have in their basement.
And we'll blow it up.
Oh, boy.
Dry ice.
That'd be a great business model. Yeah. Well, you send it to us, we'll film it, blowing it up.
I bet there's already somebody doing that.
It's the Mythbusters.
That's true. They do have the best job maybe in the planet. The next area that the show goes to is the Wall of Forever.
Yeah, Wall of Infinity.
And it's interesting. They talk about it kind of being a bit of a knowledge barrier to some extent.
Yeah.
And he says, like, you know, our early ancestors encountered it almost immediately when they looked up at the sky.
Yeah. It's gotten larger, but we haven't figured out yet how to see beyond the horizon of the universe, right? The visible universe.
Right.
Observable, actually, is the term they use, right?
Something else that he said that I thought was really cool is like they're trying to illustrate the time it takes for things to happen in these observations. So he's like, feel the sun in your face. The photons can take around 10 million years to get from the inner core of the sun to the outer, to the outside where they can just travel freely.
Right.
So the light on your face was that light you're feeling whenever you see it, this light is older than humanity.
Yeah.
It took that long to get to us.
It's crazy.
We're feeling it now. And it was created back maybe 10 million years ago.
It just got better with age.
It did. Light like fine wine.
It's a nice bouquet.
Good year.
That's right.
Especially good on the nose. I can keep this going.
No, that's all right.
They didn't. Well, then he talked about one of my favorite things, which is the cosmic microwave background. I love those images of that. And they talk about like light from the universe whenever it was about 380,000 years old. which just blows my mind that we have images from that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because that's hardly old at all, especially whenever you get – whenever you talk about the age of the universe, you always have to talk about ridiculous like billions and billions of years. And we have a picture of it before it was even a million years old. We have a picture now.
Yeah.
That's, and I think that was, you know, when stars were barely formed.
Yeah.
At that point, it was – the universe as we know it was nothing like it is now.
No.
And I think that image is a kind of proto-galaxy.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, is which it, makes sense.
A fuzzy-wuzzy sort of thing. Fuzzy-wuzzy.
Waka-waka. So.
And we are there apparently is a neutrino background from the initial Big Bang.
Right.
But I didn't get the – I don't think they actually mentioned if this is something that we can detect or that we just predict that it's there somehow.
I wasn't sure that either. And they say that may have been – I wrote down here, you know, at one point, you know, obviously we know this, the universe started small, like from a, you know, small infinite point. All the matter and energy of the cosmos, whenever he holds up that little marble.
Right.
And he said that's whenever the universe was a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth old, of a second old.
I remember what Laura said when we were watching the episode. She said, how can they know that? And I liked that she's a skeptic about this. But I just – my basic response was we'll just rewind the videotape. Just take our observations as best we know and rewind.
And here's something that would help us see that is Neil says back then that was way too hot and dense for light to move through it. Light just couldn't move through it. So we're not going to get any light ever from that. Right. But neutrinos can move through it.
Oh.
Right.
Neutrinos would have no problem moving through it.
Right. So I wasn't – because because I didn't get that he mentioned that we can detect that or not, I kind of thought that this is something that maybe the future will hold, that we will be able to detect some residual neutrinos from the initial Big Bang or slightly after. And that will help to, you know, fill in a picture of what happened. Chalmer, does that did you get the feeling that we have already been able to do this or
to detect the neutrino background?
Right.
It looks like we have not, but we only have indirect evidence for it.
Right.
Yeah. They're called relic neutrinos, but no, they haven't been confirmed.
I know just this year we're able to detect gravitational waves that suggests
inflation.
The inflation.
Which is huge.
Was well, I know
we've detected gravity waves before that.
No, I mean these specific gravity waves.
The signature of these gravity waves suggests that like it's almost like stretch marks.
Right.
Cosmic stretch marks.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a great analogy.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's so great. It's a great time to live for this kind of stuff because – you know, you see an episode that is pretty up to date, and then, you know, before the end of probably filming that episode, there could be a relevant breakthrough that enhances our understanding even further.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And they're trying to stick to – the writers did just the other day on Star Talk, Neil deGrasse Tyson had Steve Soter on there who – he wrote the original Cosmos with Carl Sagan and Andrian. And he also co-wrote this one with her again. Mm-hmm. But he said that they really were trying to stick more to the most established science they could.
Yeah, and not talk about fringe stuff too much.
Right. And he said this is because they didn't want it to be too out of date, you know, because they wanted it to be for everyone. It was interesting hearing him talk about the writing process. Like, you know, you said you don't want to make it seem like you're talking down to people who do know.
Right.
And to scientists especially. But you also want people to be able to enjoy it who don't know as much.
Yeah, and I think they're doing a great balance. I really do. Every time I see an episode, you know, I would say maybe 70, 80, depending on the episode, 80% of what they're saying I know to some extent anyway.
Yeah.
But there's enough interesting new stuff for me to learn, and I just love the way they're presenting the old stuff.
Well, I'm still getting – my mind is being blown with these episodes.
And, you know, if you really want to do quote-unquote cutting edge or fringe stuff, you know – you can just watch through the wormhole.
Right.
Yeah.
you don't need to watch Cosmos.
It's easy to watch it, though, because you have anything with Morgan Freeman attached to it and narrating it.
I know, but I got me some issues with that
show. You would have to. But
yeah, I do, too.
Yeah, that's why I don't actually enjoy watching it too much, just because I'm always like, I don't know, the whole time.
Yeah, let's take the weirdest stuff and just speculate it, and let's talk about it as if you know, we're forgetting that it's not
speculative.
Yeah.
No, and you know how you say that, like, we have to put an asterisk by a lot of this stuff? I feel like you need a whole line of fucking asterisks whenever you're watching through the wormhole.
Yeah.
So it's interesting stuff. I mean, I feel like it's more interesting from, like, thought experiment point of view, of, like, to think about that kind of stuff. Maybe from, like, a philosophical nerd point. But
I just wish it was more transparent about it being a lot of thought experiment.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
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 Any of this stuff, when you get down to the beginning of the universe, it's hard for me, even if I'm somewhat familiar with the stuff going on, it's hard for me to not have my mind blown apart a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially when we're just talking about inflation.
Inspired.
These are weird times in the universe where the laws of physics as we know them probably don't even apply anymore.
Right.
Like different laws of physics that then settled later. So these weird, you know, fine-tuning arguments. It wasn't fine-tuned then. They were still dialing it in, apparently.
Right.
They're still trying to find a station.
Yeah, I know. This actually is a big defeater to the fine-tuning argument that, you know, all the basic parameters of the universe are just right for life. Well, they're right now, and that would be part of the anthropic principle, which is, of course, they would be right now because this is when we're here to observe that they're right.
Really, that would be the best miracle for them, is if we could show that life is impossible and that we were still here anyways. That would be such a better argument for, like any kind of intelligent designer, wouldn't it?
A pseudo-Zeno argument.
Yeah.
It's like we've done the math and stuff, and it turns out it's impossible for matter to hold together at all. And here we are.
Yep. Have a nice day.
Right. Yeah. Then they would have something there.
God abandoned us, we'll all explode.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, we're about halfway through, as we've mentioned, the Cosmos series here. And so far, I'm loving it.
I'm looking forward to our podcast for the next episode.
Oh, my God.
Even more.
I can't wait.
I'm very hyped about that.
Yeah. So,
that'll be really fun.
It is. We're going to get the let out in the next one, folks. So stand by for that. But we're enjoying it. Please, you know, we value feedback. We might not always act on it, but give us some feedback. Tell us about it. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. You can find us on iTunes. If you have Stitcher, good way to listen to us. And a new way, Charmer, what network are we on again now?
We're on the Secular Broadcasting Network.
That's right.
Nice.
Secular FM.
That's right.
Yeah, and regarding feedback, I think, you know, we're open to just whether you like the show, and we're open to constructive criticism as well. Yeah. And I think that we would probably respond to some interests in, you know, hey, would you guys be interested in doing an episode on this or that? We have plenty of episode ideas. We always joke around when we're in our strategy meetings that we have way too much content. But we have no issues at all with the idea of getting some ideas for a content and answering questions, things like that. Absolutely.
No, yeah, I would love to have more episode ideas now.
Yeah.
We have so little to do with so much time. Wait, strike that. Reverse it.
Right.
Yeah. So, all right, everyone. Well, you know, thanks for tuning in. We'll be back, and we're enjoying it here. So please remember, think responsibly.